means permitted by international law.
In the light of the US backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the US brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to the nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the US gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the US calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the US-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the U.S. military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military industry, military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against the pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden had pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hi. Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms, due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Kwasi Kwarteng, Britain's business secretary, faces a legal challenge over the tax handed to oil and gas operators by campaigners. Paid to Pollute, a group of environmental organizations, says that the taxpayer handouts to oil and gas companies are unlawful because they conflict with the UK's legal duty to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. We now present you an article written by John Ungood Thomas under the heading Shell and BP paid zero tax on North Sea gas and oil for 3 years. The article has been published by The Observer. Shell and BP, which together produce more than 1.7 billion tons of greenhouse gases a year, have not paid any corporation tax on oil and gas production in the North Sea for the last 3 years. Company filings reveal the oil giants, which have an annual global footprint of greenhouse gases more than five times bigger than Britain's, are benefiting from billions of pounds of tax breaks and reliefs for oil and gas production. According to annual payments to governments report analysed by The Observer, Shell and BP paid no corporation tax or production levies on North Sea oil operations between 2018 and 2020. and claimed tax relief of nearly £400 million. Over the same three-year period, from 2018, 2019 and 2020, they paid shareholders more than £44 billion in dividends. A petroleum revenue tax of 35% was effectively scrapped by the then UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, in 2016. And oil giants can claim billions of pounds in taxpayer handouts for decommissioning rigs. The North Sea is now one of the most profitable areas in the world for oil and gas production, after tax cuts by the British government to purportedly encourage oil and gas production. Shell and BP have set targets to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 by investing in cleaner energy, but claim that the United Kingdom will continue to need oil and gas from the North Sea, which also supports thousands of jobs. Climate campaigners, however, are now challenging the UK tax regime in a High Court case. They want the payouts to be scrapped and a ban on any new oil and gas projects in the North Sea to help cut carbon emissions. Philip Evans, oil and gas campaigner for Greenpeace UK, says it's outrageous that as the United Kingdom prepares to host global climate talks, COP26 in Glasgow, we still have one of the lowest effective tax rates in the world for oil extraction. We're giving tax breaks worth billions of pounds to companies that have been fueling the climate emergency for decades. There are about 180 oil rigs in the North Sea, and the sector has generated about £360 billion in net tax revenues since 1970, which is about £7.2 billion a year. The United Kingdom has some of the lowest oil tax rates in the world. An analysis by research company Rystad Energy in January found that Britain is now the most profitable company in the world for the development of oil and gas mega projects. Taxpayers will foot a bill of more than £18 billion for the decommissioning of the oil and gas infrastructure in the North Sea up to 2065, made up of tax repayments and a reduction in offshore corporation tax. Campaigners want the handouts to be scrapped altogether and used to invest in clean energy. Kwasi Kwarteng, Britain's business secretary, faces a legal challenge over the tax handout to oil and gas operators by campaigners. Paid to Pollute, a group of environmental organisations, says that the British taxpayer handouts to oil and gas companies are unlawful because they conflict with the United Kingdom's legal duty to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. A judicial review is due to be heard before the end of the year. Gabrielle Jaliaskov, a campaigner at Platform, a UK group that investigates the social and environmental effects of the global oil industry and is supporting the legal case, said, "The government has spent too long backing oil giants through tax breaks and subsidies. It has had devastating consequences for the climate." Oil giants Shell and BP also face strong opposition over new projects in the North Sea. A report published recently by Friends of the Earth and the New Economics Foundation found that the oil and gas industry is preparing to seek approval for 30 offshore projects by 2025. Shell has defended plans for the Cambo project, a controversial oil field off the Shetland Islands that contains about 800 million barrels of oil, and is awaiting approval from the Oil and Gas Authority, a government licensing body. Greenpeace lost a legal bid recently for the government to revoke the permit for BP to drill at the Vorlich oil field in the North Sea, which started production in November of last year. It was reported by Reuters news agency recently that offshore petroleum regulator for environment and decommissioning had rejected Shell's plans to develop the Jackdaw gas field in the North Sea after considering its environmental statement. A Shell spokesperson said, our total oil production already peaked in 2019 and we expect it to continue to decline, including through divestments. We're already investing billions of dollars in low-carbon energy. The North Sea transition deal agreed earlier this year also maps out how the sector will reduce emissions in line with the government's net zero targets. The company said it paid no corporation tax on North Sea production last year because of tax losses in previous years. A BP spokesperson said all BP's North Sea assets are owned by companies that are subject to British tax in accordance with British laws. Over the years, BP has contributed over £40 billion in taxes to the UK government from its North Sea business. The spokesperson added, in recent years, in line with long-standing UK tax regulations, tax relief on the significant investments we have recently made in the North Sea business and the challenging price environment, including the steep oil price falls in 2015 and in 2020, have meant we have paid no North Sea corporate taxes. A British government spokesperson said the UK oil and gas industry has paid around £375 billion in production taxes to date, with companies in the North Sea subject to headline rates that are more than double those paid by other businesses. Relief for decommissioning costs is a fundamental part of the British tax system.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, how do you go from being known as a liar and people demanding your conviction for war crimes to being crowned a knight? It seems all you need is a royal touch in England, as Queen Elizabeth deems that former Prime Minister Tony Blair is worthy of becoming Sir Tony. Are the lies he told about the war in Iraq being rewarded, or is it the lack of remorse that he showed for helping to destroy millions of lives in Iraq and Afghanistan that's being honored? Does this all symbolize that all lives are definitely not equal to the British elite? Well, stay with us as we take a look at this on this Spotlight. I'm going to start this conversation off by crossing over to London, talking to Saeed Pourreza. Saeed, well, tell me, what's going on and what's being said on that side of things?
You raised some very good questions, and I think the late legendary journalist Robert Fisk, who had nothing but contempt for Tony Blair, the African anti-apartheid hero, now deceased, Desmond Tutu, really turned in their graves at the news. And as for peace activists and anti-war campaigners, they're dismayed at this announcement. This is a man, as you say, who took Britain to a war, an unprovoked war with Iraq in 2003. And we know how that turned out. We'll get to that in a minute. This is a man who called fatuous the millions of people who turned out on the weekend of February 15th trying to stop the U.S.-UK-led invasion of Iraq. He called them fatuous, as I say. And we all remember how the war in Afghanistan turned out. Prior to that, in the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, we saw the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, millions of lives lost in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that war came to an ignominious, humiliating end this past summer in Iraq. In particular, 1 million dead, 3 million dispossessed, and the permanent destabilization of the region. The so-called war on terror that is blamed for the subsequent increase in the reach and influence of terrorist groups such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda. Blair is being described, has already earned the title of Sir War Criminal by people who know the truth about these wars and what he and George Bush and Rumsfeld and Colin Powell committed in those years. Desmond Tutu, as I said earlier, and many others around the world have for long and on many occasions called for Tony Blair to be tried at the International Criminal Court, just like some African leaders have and some Asian leaders have been tried there. But it seems, they say, that there's a set of rules for those and a different set of rules when it comes to Western and American leaders. And as for the honor system, Marzia, this is the same title that was awarded, similar title, awarded to the fascist Italian dictator Benito Mussolini and the disgraced pedophile BBC host Jimmy Savile. So that what experts are saying is that what this whole thing shows is the contempt in which the British elite holds the public, and the disconnect and the lack of touch exhibited by the monarchy. This is a decision made by the Queen, right, with the real people in here in the UK and for the international community.
Okay. Well, thanks so much to Saeed, his correspondent out of London, for bringing us the latest of what's happening on the ground there. Now, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight out of London, journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Well, interesting. This is a really interesting turn of events, Hafsa. Your overall assessment, and wow, the first day of the new year. I mean, is this what the year is going to be about? But go ahead, Hafsa.
Well, my first reaction was absolute disgust, and I think it mirrors the opinion of millions of prostitutes who actually watched in horror as the news unfolded, revealing that a war criminal, the man who undermined democracy as well, and actually is responsible for the erosion of the faith people have in British politics, was actually rewarded with one of the highest orders you have in this rather decrepit system. So I think revulsion very much is the word that applies to the situation. And let's not forget that aside from his role in the criminal war on Iraq that left a country eviscerated, that led to the sectarian conflict that we know, that led to the consequences that were previously talked about in your introduction, this is a man who also whored himself out to very corrupt governments and regimes who were paying him very huge amounts of money for his advice. And he showed absolutely no regard for who they were or what they did or what they represented, and was happily offering his services to the highest bidder. So I think this really reveals something very disturbing about the way the British establishment operates, and also at a time where there was a somber mood in Britain as a result of the COVID pandemic. Mm. Everyone was expecting good news, and this is what they got from their sovereign. Sadly.
Yes. Well, John, your take, why do you think that the Queen took this action, and especially now, there's so much discontent right now in the UK and dealing with the, we saw the reactions to the government and this whole COVID situation. So your assessment of what has just happened and why?
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Just when you think that it could not get any lower, this rancid British political establishment ruling class does exactly that. This is a profound insult, first and foremost, to the people of Iraq and the wider region, whose lives were upended by this illegal war, of which Tony Blair was a prime mover. It's a profound insult to the families of the 179 British soldiers who were killed in this war, based on a lie, and also the hundreds more maimed for life as a consequence of this war. It really does speak to a completely out of touch monarchy, especially at a time when Prince Andrew has been implicated in paedophilia with regards to his connection with Jeffrey Epstein, the disgraced now dead paedophile and international financier, and Ghislaine Maxwell, who's just been found guilty of grooming young girls for his pleasure and the pleasure of his friends, allegedly including Prince Andrew. So it really does mark a low point in British political, constitutional affairs. Tony Blair is one of the most hated figures, not only in the UK, but around the world. And as your other guests quite eloquently put it, there's been a massive backlash to this decision. It's a catastrophic decision at a time when the royal family has never been more unpopular. And I think there could be no stronger argument, and there are many stronger arguments, for the abolition of this semi-feudal institution which sits at the apex of British society.
Since the 2003 American-British invasion of Iraq, I mean, that country has seen millions of lives disrupted, terrorism, instability. So the message that the Queen is giving here, are the actions done by that government at that time being basically rewarded? I mean, is this what she wants, approving of instability in this region?
I mean, this decision really beggars belief, and I fail to see what she can achieve from this decision, knowing how unpopular Tony Blair is. And as I said, he's not simply unpopular because of the wars. He's unpopular for the consequences of the war, the fact that so many people lost faith in British politics because of his blatant lies, when he lied to the British public by claiming that there was an imminent threat of 45 minutes if the British army and the US didn't invade Iraq. So the consequences of that criminal conflict have been far-reaching, and we still experience them to this day. And you'd expect a monarch in her, essentially what we can, I mean, say, dying days, she's definitely in her twilight years, she would leave with sort of a clean and wonderful legacy. I think she's leaving with something, a big, big stain on her legacy by actually rewarding in such a way such a hateful and hated figure and a criminal, really, who should be behind bars as opposed to being honored in this way.
Well, John, doesn't it show a detachment and perhaps arrogance that even though, as you said, the majority of people dislike Blair, and despite that, despite the calls for this man to be actually prosecuted, Then he is given knighthood. There seems not only to be detachment, but basically arrogance, that not even caring what the British public thinks.
Well, it's an unalloyed provocation. It has provoked strong feelings, as I've said, as your other guest has said, strongly amongst the British public. Because everybody understands who was around at that time, and I myself was a proud foot soldier in the anti-war movement, a time of hope. I remember vividly 15 million people marching around the world on February 15, 2003 in the last gasp effort to stop this war. We all knew it was based on lies. We all knew what was coming down the track. We all knew that it would end in disaster. We all knew that the claim that the Iraqi people would meet the British and American troops with flowers as liberators was a lie, was false, and that there would be chaos. We just did not know how deep-reaching the chaos would be, and it has been far-reaching. And let's make this clear. I mean, this led directly to 7/7 in London in 2005, the terrorist attack. It led to the formation of ISIS. It led to the chaos in Syria. It's led to unimaginable suffering for millions of people around the world, specifically and particularly and mainly in the Middle East, but also in Europe and the US. There have been terror attacks, all spawned by this criminal war. Tony Blair should have faced justice for his part in this war. We know that he knew that the intelligence was concocted. His press officer, Alistair Campbell, again sanctified and rehabilitated by the British establishment, was involved in the dodgy dossier in conjunction with Richard Dearlove. So Richard Dearlove, now another part of that crime, this triptych of criminals responsible for this war, for Britain's role in this war. No one has faced a second of justice for the calamity of Iraq, and this just puts the lid on it. And I think we are now heading for a reckoning with this rancid British establishment. We can no longer live on the Union Jack. We can no longer live on British obscurantism surrounding the Second World War. And the problem we have with those British obscurantism around the Second World War is that every war that Britain's been involved in since then has been painted as a rerun of the Second World War. And it also does legitimise the slaughter of Arab people, of Muslims, of black and brown people in the Global South. A bad day for justice in British society.
Well, interesting point that you made, John, and I want to look at that because as both of you have said, that Tony Blair and, of course, others should have been prosecuted. First of all, is it too late? Do you think that there still could be some ramifications for what they did in Iraq? Let's start from there.
Well, I mean, you'd hope, but obviously this latest step sort of shows that there is absolute contempt for the loss of lives of Iraqis and the consequences of that war. You'd have thought that Tony Blair would have been, at the very least, if not behind bars, at least sort of ignored and not constantly invited to give his opinion on Brexit, on the EU, on everything,
right,
and now obviously being rewarded. And the sad thing, I think we have to also mention, this is a very, very sad day for democracy, because the one person who is behind bars today is actually one of the people who exposed the lies and the crimes that went on in Iraq as a result of this war. And of course, it's Julian Assange, who is actually rotting away in a prison cell with absolutely no access to fair justice, while this man is being rewarded and being given the red carpet treatment. So I think this is an extraordinary sad day and a worrying day for the future of democracy in this country.
Well, do you think, John, I'll go back to you. I mean, if, as Hafsa has said, one would think that at the very least, if he wasn't prosecuted, he would just basically fade away in the background. But not only is that not happening, now we have the Queen bringing this up again. Actually, it's like adding salt to the wounds, when one would think that the establishment in general would want to try to forget this as much as possible. Your thoughts on that side of it?
Well, it just goes to prove, I mean, they don't understand the country which they're ruling over. There's a chasm between the lives of the ruling class in the UK in 2022 at the start of another year, and the lives of many, many working class people who are suffering the consequences of COVID, of austerity, of poverty, of low wages, of all depredations of this ruling class, which, as I say, goes ever more criminally detached from its own people. And this is just another example of it. I think it's another nail in the coffin, and I think as soon as this ruling class is sent on its way into the dustbin of history, the better. I think, as I say, there will be a reckoning. You can only dine out on the myths surrounding the Second World War. You can only dine out on the myths surrounding the Union Jack for so long. And increasingly, all they have left are those myths.
Perhaps it's going to add some clarity to the reality of the British government. I mean, we know its imperialist past and what it stood for. But now with the media, perhaps others thought it stood for something else. And yet again, we see non-white people, especially, basically their lives being put not on the same level as others. No respect now for the millions who have been killed or have lost their homes and lacking stability now in Iraq and, of course, also Afghanistan. Again, it just seems to be like someone saying, we really don't care about your people and what you think.
This is exactly it. And I mean, imagine if the situation was reversed in any Arab or Muslim country, someone had rewarded posthumously, for instance, Osama bin Laden for his work and his career. You know, there'd be absolute shock and astonishment at this decision, and rightly so. But obviously, when it's a white leader responsible for the mass murders of scores of black and brown people, in this case, Arabs and Muslims, he's actually rewarded and he's feted in this way. So it is extraordinarily shocking, it's provocative, it's very offensive, it's very insulting, and it's a repugnant, you know, situation we're going through. Sadly, I have to say, I mean, I'd love to know, to think that there is a day of reckoning, but I'm assuming that over the next few days, we're going to see articles in The Guardian about how wonderful Tony Blair's legacy was, that he actually did things for women's rights or something for the economy. And we're going to start building him up again so as to appease the population, which is extraordinarily angry. And it's very interesting to note that even the Daily Mail, which is a right-wing newspaper and which supported his policies and his economic policies and his wars, has actually highlighted the anger of the population regarding this decision. But sadly, I'm assuming that the establishment media is going to rally and actually back this decision and find excuses that this was actually a right decision by the Queen.
I mean, Jeff, what do you make of it that, as I said to Haps in the very beginning, that it was done on today? I mean, the beginning of a new year where people are looking for, I would think, hope, optimism, especially after the last 2 years of hell, basically, for the world.
Well, on a constitutional level, it was done according to protocol. Every ex-prime minister has received this order of the garter from the Queen. It took the Queen 14 years to give it to Tony Blair, perhaps because she'd understood the controversy. But she'd been badly advised, probably thought that memories would fade, that the Iraq war has receded into the mists of time. But the backlash I have found quite inspiring. And AFSA mentioned quite rightly the establishment media's attempt to rehabilitate Blair, and that's true. But we have what we did not have at the time of the Iraq war today, social media. And that has proved increasingly subversive. And if you were on Twitter today, you would not have missed the huge, huge cascading waves of anger at this decision from every part of the political spectrum. Even GB News, the Britain's Fox News, as rebarbative as it is, they had commentators who were excoriating this decision by the Queen to award this award to Tony Blair at this time. So it's universal anger. It's another own goal and a part of establishment, which, as I said earlier, grows increasingly detached from the rest of society. And that can only be a bad thing, because when the ruling class is unable to rule in the old way, and the working class and the poor are unwilling to be ruled in the old way, then you reach a revolutionary period. And I don't think it's hyperbole to state that we're moving into the arms of such a revolutionary period in the UK as we move into the new year of 2022.
I'm sorry, go ahead, John, what did you say at the end?
I said it could not come soon enough, a revolutionary period. We can't go on as we are. The contradictions are insurmountable increasingly. The contradictions unleashed by Brexit, the contradictions unleashed by COVID, the gap in the lives of those at the top and those in the middle and the bottom, it could not be greater. And this welter of anger that's been misdirected hitherto, I think we'll only need a political movement that can understand where the anger should be directed. They've done away with Corbyn, but in many ways Corbyn was our father Gapon. Historians will understand what I mean. They have yet to meet our Lenin, and he's coming.
Well, Hafsa, do you think, like John, that we're going to see blowback from this and with the whole establishment itself, especially when we look at that this decision was made by the Queen, and then all the other signs of corruption that we have seen from the British government in general, especially last year? Your take on that?
I mean, I'd love to agree, but I mean, sadly, we've seen that, for instance, Boris Johnson has been involved in scandal after scandal, and he seems to be absolutely resistant to any form of budging. And actually, as we are fuming over this decision today, something very sinister has happened. Priti Patel, the Home Office, has vowed to introduce laws to curb more protest and any form of active protesting in the coming weeks. So I think that although there is a burgeoning anger, and I think that in any normal society we've seen across Europe protests in France, in Austria, in Italy over various decisions, for instance, related to COVID, I think there is, you know, in Britain there is apathy when it comes to political protest. And with new laws being introduced that will curb any future sort of form of protest, I think that's unlikely to happen. But of course, I do wish I'm wrong, because I do think that something very wrong has happened today, and something very wrong has been happening over the past few months. I think we've seen the erosion of democracy, and it did start actually, ironically, with Tony Blair. And I think ideally, yes, this could be the sort of spark that pushes people into reacting and putting an end to what is going on today with the British establishment, yes.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mostafa out of London, and writer and political analyst John White out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
In Britain, doctors say some NHS workers can't work due to shortage of tests, as UK Health Secretary Sajid Javid admits supply is constrained. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart and Richard Adams. The piece is titled "Javid Urged to Prioritise COVID Tests for NHS Workers or Risk Patient Harm in UK." Britain's Health Secretary Sajid Javid is being urged to ensure NHS workers are prioritised for COVID tests or risk a devastating impact on patient care, after conceding to MPs that the supply of lateral flow kits would have to be constrained over the next fortnight in light of rocketing demand. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which represents doctors, warned that the system for ensuring NHS staff receive tests was not working. It said its members were reporting problems with obtaining PCR and lateral flow tests, despite healthcare workers supposedly being given priority for both. The British Medical Association's Chair of Council, Dr. Chand Nagpal, said, "Being unable to get the tests means staff may not be legally allowed to work, and at a time of acute workforce shortages and winter pressures, this could be devastating for the care that can be given right across the National Health Service." Demand for tests has been surging in recent days, with new infections increasing rapidly and ministers, including the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, advising the public to test themselves before attending New Year Eve parties or meeting vulnerable relatives. Another factor boosting demand is that the self-isolation period in England was recently cut from 10 days to 7 days, but only with 2 negative lateral flow tests. Official figures showed that 189,213 new cases were reported in the United Kingdom in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. local time on Thursday, 30th of December, and 332 people died within 28 days of a positive COVID test, although this included hospital death figures from England since 24th of December. NHS statistics showed that 11,452 people in England were in hospital with COVID-19 as of the morning of 30th of December, up 61% in a week, and the highest number since 26th of February. Health Secretary Sajid Javid has acknowledged in a letter to MPs that the supply of lateral flow tests may have to be constrained over the next fortnight. He wrote on Wednesday night, 29th of December, "In light of the huge demand for lateral flow tests or lateral flow devices seen over the last 3 weeks, we expect to need to constrain the system at certain points over the next 2 weeks to manage supply over the course of each day, with the new tranches of supply released regularly throughout each day." The Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has written to Sajid Javid calling on him to make sure healthcare workers are given priority for testing. He wrote, "I urge you to put the key workers we have relied upon for the past 2 years to the front of the queue and do everything you can to prevent a staffing shortage crisis within our National Health Service. The government must get a grip on this crisis, bring these shortages to an end, and ensure everyone can access tests quickly and regularly." A Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson rejected the idea that healthcare workers had been unable to obtain tests, claiming they had their own dedicated supply channel. Azim Majid, a professor of primary care and public health at Imperial College London, said the government was in part to blame for the shortages of tests because of its advice to the public to test themselves before social events and outings. He said in an article in The Guardian, "It has become very clear that there are nowhere near enough lateral flow tests for COVID-19 in England to allow the government's policy of their indiscriminate use." He called for the publication of daily data on how many tests are available, and then clear guidance from the government on what groups should be prioritized for testing and how frequently they should test. Meanwhile, the Welsh Government announced on Thursday, 30th of December, that it had lent an additional 4 million lateral flow testing kits to England to help alleviate the supply squeeze across the border, bringing the total offered to 10 million. The National Education Union, NEU, has called for teachers to be among the groups given priority, amid concerns about whether sufficient tests will be available as the new term starts in the coming days. Mary Boosted, the Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, said, "If schools are the top priority, as Boris Johnson has said they are, there is a case for teachers being given a priority, being made a priority group, so that they can test themselves, so they can be in school educating pupils. With all secondary pupils expected to be tested before they start the spring term, the Liberal Democrats have urged the Education Secretary, Nazem Zahawi, to ensure every school has enough tests in place." The Liberal Democrats' education spokesperson, Monira Wilson, said, "Nazem Zahawi must provide a cast-iron guarantee that every child and teacher who needs a COVID test will be able to access one on the first day of term to avoid yet more disruption to schools in the coming days. We cannot afford a repeat of last year's fiasco when pupils returned for one day before being sent home again. A Department for Education spokesperson claimed the government had delivered 28 million test kits to schools in the final 2 weeks of last term. The spokesperson said, "Schools and colleges use a different priority supply route to get their lateral flow tests. Most test kits have already been received for the start of the new term, and we have emergency arrangements in place to make sure every school has a testing kit that it needs." One South London headteacher, Ben Roberts of Heathbrook Primary School in Lambeth, said his school had ordered tests from the Department for Education 2 weeks before the end of term and was yet to receive them. He said he had been touring local pharmacies trying to obtain test kits. He added, "We were expecting staff to go in for an inset day on Tuesday, 28th of December. If staff haven't had a test prior to that, all we're doing is super spreading again. So I, for the last few days, have been trying every which way to get hold of any more." The Pharmaceutical Services Negotiating Committee, or PSNC, which represents National Health Service community pharmacies in England, said some pharmacy staff were being verbally abused when stocks of lateral flow tests ran out. Alistair Buxton, the Pharmaceutical Services Negotiating Committee's Director of National Health Services, said, "The public demand for test kits remains exceptionally high, and despite UK HSA delivering some 2 million tests to pharmacy wholesalers on some days, this is still falling short of demand. Members of the public, being directed to pharmacies for tests, are rightly frustrated when they cannot get them. But it's concerning that some pharmacy teams say they are still being verbally abused when this happens." A government spokesperson claimed the National Health Service has additional stock of lateral flow tests, and those who live or work in vulnerable settings have access to dedicated testing order routes. "If at some point it is necessary to do so, we will always prioritize protecting the most vulnerable as well as critical workers, as we have done throughout the pandemic when it comes to vaccines, boosters, testing and other infection control measures such as personal protective equipment." Moreover, industry representatives said a lack of tests in England could mean the efforts of restaurants, clubs to host New Year's Eve celebrations are in vain.